So I want to start today by thanking you all for coming. And what we're going to do today really is just go over the handouts that I have. Because we're going to talk about the regulation of regular cell growth and how it goes off in cancer. It turns out that it's pretty hard to talk about normal cell growth and or cancer separately because the two overlap so much. So we're going to start out by looking at handout A and the issue of the cell cycle, which I want to remind you about. If you look at the bottom of your handout, we have a review of the cell cycle, that there is mitosis and then DNA replication, or S, occurs at a separate time. And that there is a time in between mitosis before S. Now, this is the cell cycle for eukaryotic cells, and the interesting part is that you have this gap 1, or this period gearing up to DNA synthesis, but not doing it yet. And then you have S, where you do DNA synthesis, and by now we know that DNA never lies around by itself. It's always wound up in nucleosomes with histones. So in this period of S, not only do you have to make DNA, but you have to make all the histones with which to wrap up the DNA. And then you have G2, which is a period after you finish S, but you don't start mitosis right away. There's a space where you do whatever you need to get your act together, and then, only then, do you do mitosis. So this is the basic cell cycle. We've talked about this before. Now, people have discovered that there are what they call checkpoints in the cell cycle. And you could say that these are decision points. These are points at which cells have to make a decision whether to continue or not. And the reason they were discovered is that when cells have something wrong with a cell cycle, they don't usually stop at any old random point. They stop at a limited number of points. That's where they hang up. And the two main checkpoints are listed on your handout. One involves the transition from G1 to S. But the actual decision point is somewhere back here in G1. And this is often called the start point. And the cell cycle is sometimes considered to start there, though of course it's a cycle, it's not sure that this means anything. And the other checkpoint is the transition between G2 to M. So these are called the G2 checkpoint and either the G1S checkpoint or start. Now you notice I have this thing called G0 here. Many of your cells, or the cells in any multicellular organism, in the adult, many of the cells don't divide, like the nerve cells in your brain. They sit around, they do their thing, but they're very highly specialized or differentiated, and they're never going to divide again. In fact, some people argue that once you're all specialized, you're actually incapable of dividing. You have to make up your mind. You have to do one or the other. So cells that are never going to divide again, or not in anywhere near the immediate future, are said to really not be cycling. They're off the cell cycle, off the main path, and they're said to be in G0. And these are cells that are usually differentiated. And the decision of whether to enter G0, specialize, differentiate, and just sit around, or whether to keep going into S, that seems to be the critical checkpoint or start. Now, the reason why one meaning of this being a checkpoint is what happens if a cell goes past this checkpoint? That means it's going to go through S, it's going to go through G2, and basically until it gets to here, there are no more decisions. Now, in the cells of an adult such as yourself, the big deal, the big decision point seems to be start, this one. That's the critical point which determines what a cell will do in an adult. But in an embryo, it turns out that the critical point is probably the other one, the G2M transition point. If you think about what goes on in an early embryo, you remember you have a fertilized egg, and it's usually pretty big. And it divides in half, and then in half again, and then in half, and it doesn't generally grow in size. The cells get smaller and smaller and smaller until you get back to normal cell size. So at that stage, that process is usually called cleavage. And what has to happen there is, in order to for a cell to cleave, for an embryo to divide in half, what do you have to double? The protein is already many times over double. Probably most of the RNA is 2. But the thing you have to double is the DNA and maybe the associated histones. So you have to double your chromosomes. Pretty much everything else is already taken care of. So one way to think about it is that in a cleaving egg, whatever goes on in G1, you can largely dispense with. Whatever goes on in G2, you can pretty much get rid of. So all you're really doing is S, M, S, M. So the G1S switch is sort of an override. It's an automatic on. And the big decision is this one. Have I doubled my chromosomes? Am I ready to roll and do mitosis? If so, yes. And then we proceed around again. So this is the cleavage point, G2M, in early embryos. This is the critical decision point. And the critical decision point in adult cells is probably G1S. Now, we're going to concentrate on G1S because it turns out that in cancer cells, what is usually wrong is regulation of the G1S start point. Now, there are other things as well, but that seems to be the founding mistake, that this switch is not properly regulated. Now, some of the things we're going to talk about were discovered by looking at the G2M switch instead of the G1S, because the basic underlying mechanism appears to be the same. And so we may go back and forth, but the one we're really interested in is this G1S. Now, in general, in an adult, what controls G1 to S? For cells to pass either of these checkpoints, and there are others, although we are not talking about them, in order for a cell to get past the checkpoint, everything has to be right. Whatever was supposed to be built and ready to roll has to be ready. And if for any reason one component is missing, the cell will not proceed. However, in a cell that's in a multicellular organism, just being sure that you're okay is not enough. You have to be sure you're right in relation to your neighbors, that you're not growing too much, that you're not lagging behind. And so, in an adult, generally, to go from G1 to S, you need not only for everything internal to be right, but you need a paracrine signal, almost always. And the signal is usually a growth factor. Which is usually apparent. So, as you'll see in cancer cells, a lot of the problem has to do with the regulation of growth factors and their activity. That gets off. Now, how do you regulate these checkpoints? What is it that a cell does that enables it to pass a checkpoint? It turns out to pass a checkpoint, either one of these two, the cell has to contain an active kinase. So it has to have a checkpoint kinase. Now, by now we know what a kinase is. It catalyzes the phosphorylation of something. And these are all protein kinases. So there's some enzyme that has to be both present inside the cell and in active form. And there's one for G1S and a different one for G2M. And each of these has to be ready to go, or you can't get past the checkpoint. In order for it to get ready to go for G1S, you need the kick, the growth factor from the outside, as well as all the inside stuff. For G2M, you probably just need inside stuff, that everything is ready for mitosis, and then you're ready to go. Now, the question is, let's look more at these kinases. Now, there's a lot of ways of looking at it, but one is, what do you need these kinases for? And that's in that little table on the top of your handout. What kind of protein would you have to phosphorylate, for example, to get from G2 to M? We've already discussed before that during at that transition, you phosphorylate histones, that you phosphorylate lamins. You have to phosphorylate histones so the nucleosomes can fold up tighter and the chromosomes can condense. You have to phosphorylate lamins so the nuclear membrane can come apart and so that you can clear the decks to do mitosis. And there's also microtubule-associated proteins. That's why it says MAPS in your little table. Some microtubule-associated proteins also have to be phosphorylated so the microtubules can rearrange and form the spindle fibers. So those bunch of proteins have to be phosphorylated at this point. G2 to M. And the kinase that does it has been named MPF. And that's because it, the real name comes from the way it was discovered. But what it is said to stand for is mitosis promoting factor. But remember, this is internal. This is a kinase inside the cell. And if it's ready to go, the cell will go into M. Now, the kinase that you need to go from G1 to S, because this is the start point, so-called, is called the start kinase. So you have MPF is required for G2 to M, and the start kinase is required for G1 to S. Now, remember I said that there's a lot of similarity between the switch at each of these checkpoints. And in both of these, it turns out that the kinases are related. Now, one of the things I forgot to say here is, we said what you need to do for go from G2 to M. What do you have to do to go from G1 to S? And it turns out that that's on your little table on the top. You notice it says that you have to phosphorylate largely transcription factors or transcription factor inhibitors. Phosphorylation of a protein, what does that do? Does it make it better or worse? It depends on the protein. Sometimes phosphorylation activates the protein, sometimes it inhibits it. Now, it turns out that there's some factors that are must be active to get the show on the road, and phosphorylation activates them. There are also proteins that block further procedure until everything is okay. And the phosphorylation inactivates them. So it takes off the brake, so to speak. So phosphorylation can, in fact, inhibit an inhibitor, so to speak, or activate an activator. And these are largely transcription factors when you're talking about G1 to S. And this will, what will this allow you to do? If you're going to go from G1 to S, you're going to have to make new proteins to make more DNA, and you're going to have to make histones. So those are largely transcription factors that you would need to get through S, to make the proteins that you would need to get through S. Now, it turns out that each of these kinases, either MPF or the start kinase, have a very, very important feature in common, that they have two parts. So if we draw the kinase over here, the kinase meaning the active working enzyme. And it has a catalytic part, and it has a regulatory part. Now, the catalytic part is usually called a CDK for cell division kinase. And the regulatory part, which is actually activates the catalytic part, is called a cyclin. Now, we've talked about two checkpoints. There are actually more. And so there are a bunch of different cell division kinases, CDK1, CDK2, CDK3, in charge of different transitions. And similarly, there are a bunch of cyclins, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., in charge of different transitions. Now, the CDKs are different. The cyclins are usually, let me say it the other way. The cyclins, I think, are always different for different checkpoints, and the CDKs usually are. But sometimes you use the same CDK with two different cyclins to get through different places. And this depends on the cell, the organism that we're talking about. Now, what is common about these two and special about them is that the cell division kinase, or the catalytic unit, is stable. It's always there, but it won't work unless it has its partner cyclin. So why does the kinase, for start, only work at this checkpoint? It's around all the time. But cyclin is made cyclically. That's how we get its name. So a cell doesn't have start cyclin until somewhere around here. Start cyclin builds up during the cycle, but you don't have enough of it until you get to the critical decision point. At the critical decision point, if the cell is fated to divide, that is, fated first to enter S, make DNA, and divide, then if the cell is going to keep cycling, then it makes enough cyclin to bind to and activate the kinase, and you actually get through this transition point or checkpoint. So cyclin is made cyclically. That's where its name comes from. And people were very excited when they discovered this because they couldn't understand how a cell kept time. And cyclin sort of explains how a cell keeps time, and that it makes it and makes it and makes it up till you hit a critical value. And then, as we'll discuss, it's unstable. So once you have enough cyclin to activate the kinase and pass the transition point, the cyclin's degraded, and you start over from zero. Now, it turns out that not only cyclin, but cyclin messenger RNA also is unstable. So in order to make cyclin, you have to make new message. You translate that message to make cyclin. When the cyclin hits a critical level, you degrade the cyclin. Where? It's a cytoplasmic protein. So proteasomes chew it up. And the messenger RNA is also destroyed, and then you start over again. So the picture in the middle shows you the cycle. Now, that particular picture comes not from looking at what happens at start, but it comes from looking at what happens at G2 to M. It's the same idea, that you have a stable kinase subunit and you build up cyclin. But it's a different CDK and a different cyclin. But since this is the picture that everybody always publishes, I've copied it. So this is the idea that this is time, and this is relative concentration. Now, what that means is, why relative? Relative to the size of the cell or the total protein in the cell. When cells get bigger, they have more CDK. But the amount per volume, it's been corrected per volume. Now, you notice what we've got here is we're measuring MPF activity. That is how active the kinase is that you need to go from G2 to M. And you notice it's cyclical. Now, when does this happen? you look on the top, you see that the peak of MPF activity is at the G2 to M transition. That's when it peaks. Now, if we were following start kinase instead, how different would this look? We'd have similar picture, similar intervals. Once a cell cycle, the kinase would hit a max of activity, how well it works. But when would the start kinase hit max? It looks like it would be around here. So it would be near the end of G1, the start of S. So we would shift the picture relative to the position in the cell cycle, but other than that, the picture would be the same. But that's only activity of the enzyme, how well it works. What about cyclin? If we just looked at the amount of cyclin in the cell, what's happening? Cyclin is building up, starting here, builds up, builds up, builds up, hits a critical level, and then it falls off. So you notice that there's a picture that looks like this. That is the amount of cyclin per cell, the relative amount of cyclin of the appropriate cyclin. And the mRNA for cyclin would look similar. So now I have a question for you. What about the amount of CDK? The amount of catalytic subunit. If I plotted that on this curve, what would it look like? So I want you to stop for a second. Some of you it's obvious, but stop for a second. Discuss it with the person next to you and be sure you agree. If I did CDK amount as opposed to cyclin amount, what would CDK look like? Now, it's very quiet in here, which I'm going to take to mean either you have no idea or you're sure. So you want to tell me? I'll let her. She looks more eager. What do you think it would look like?
It would be flat.
It would be flat. Because, what?
Because it's always made, it's just not active all the time.
CDK is made so that it stays at a constant level per cell volume, but it's not active. And it's stable, it lies around. So the CDK amount would be like this. Wherever I decide to draw it, it would be flat. Okay. Okay. So it looks like we understand how cells normally regulate growth. That when they get to this point in the adult, if cyclin has been made, then the CDK will be activated, and the cell will then go into S and more or less automatically go around the cycle. The argument here is that a cancer cell doesn't go around faster. What happens with a cancer cell is when it gets to this decision point, it just keeps going. It's automatic that it will continue, not go into G0, not wait for further instructions, but go ahead. Now, in order to see why that happens, we have to look a little more closely. And for that, you need the second try to the handout. You need B. It turns out that it's not enough to make cyclin. Once you make cyclin, and the cyclin gets together with the catalytic subunit, the combination is not yet active. It has to be modified by other kinases and enzymes before it will work. So that's why this complicated thing on the top here, that if you have CDK, which is stable, and cyclin, newly made, and they get it together, you still have a complex but it still isn't active. Now, what tells a cell to make cyclin anyway? It turns out that the growth factor is usually required from the outside to kick in cyclin production. So we're going to come back to that, but you normally need a growth factor if you're talking about start cyclin. And it's the presence of the growth factor which allows you to make the cyclin, which allows you to make the complex. Now, this, what happens right here is what's written actually in the box on the bottom left, which we're going to ignore for now. Maybe we'll come back to. But there's a whole bunch of steps in there. That you have a ligand on the outside of the cell, binds to a receptor, triggers a pathway, and the cell makes cyclin. But now the cyclin and the CDK get it together, but it still doesn't work. And in order to work, you have to have an active complex, which, and we're talking here about the start kinase. Now we know what the start kinase does. It phosphorylates the proteins that you need to go from G1 to S. And so we just put that in. It adds, it's a kinase, so it adds phosphate to the target proteins. Now exactly what these are is another question to which we will return. And you notice there's a little note here that the fuss about what some of these proteins are is in the box on the bottom right, and we'll come back to that too. But what happens at this point? You phosphorylate the critical proteins. They're going to allow you, they're going to catalyze whatever you need, make whatever you need. You're going to go into S. But then what? After you pass a checkpoint, the cyclin is degraded and declines. So what's going to happen is this complex is going to come apart. So this complex is sort of the trigger to move across the checkpoint. But once you get across the checkpoint, the complex comes apart to CDK, which still lies around. That curve is flat but doesn't do anything. And the cyclin, which is degraded in the proteasome. Now it's worse than this. You notice up here it says modifications. It turns out that you need multiple modifications. You have to put some phosphates on and take some phosphates off in order to get this to work. So there's a whole bunch of enzymes in here, and we've just put them all together. And this process is inhibited by a protein called P53. And this is a very important protein because it is mutated and inactive in a very large proportion of cancers. Yeah?
Just a quick question about the graph.
Yeah.
Would you be able to draw the CDK concentration and the start kinase concentration on that as well, besides the MPF?
This is a, his question is about this picture. This is what it would look like if this were the MPF kinase, the CDK of MPF,
so CDK
and the cyclin required for MPF.
I guess I'm not following what the relationship is between CDK and MPF.
Okay, so the answer here is at this point you need a two-part enzyme, cyclin plus CDK. At this point you need one also. But the actual CDK and cyclin involved are different. So they'd be called CDK1 and CDK2, cyclin 1 and cyclin 2.
So CDK plus cyclin at G2 MPF.
So this exactly. So this well, yes. So MPF. the only question is his question is: would you call the complex here MPF, or would you call the CDK part MPF? But I think you would call the complex here MPF. And the complex here start kinase.
But that complex is the combination of CDK.
But in both cases, the complex that you need, an active kinase, has both a catalytic subunit and a cyclin regulatory subunit. That part is the same. So the difference here is if this were for the start kinase, it would be a different cyclin and a different CDK, but the pattern would be the same. But what would be different is if I drew the cell cycle up here, it would be shifted. Any more questions before I go on about any of this? Okay. Now, this looks like a horrendous mess. Why is the regulation of getting from G1 to S, big deal, such a huge production? Obviously, to go from G1 to S, an awful lot of things have to go right. You have to have the growth factor, which triggers a whole bunch of signaling stuff, which allows you to make cyclin. Then the cyclin has to find the right CDK. You have to make the complex. Then the complex has to be modified by a rather large number of enzymes, and P53 has to mind its own business. If both of those happen, then you get an active complex. Then the active complex does its thing. Once we get to this stage, we're pretty much okay. Now, why is it so complicated? When you think about you, how carefully do you have to regulate the growth of your individual cells? What if you didn't? You just let them grow. You'd be one big fat tumor. Okay. You obviously can't let cells grow out of proportion. You know, your liver has to fit the size of your abdomen, and your brain cells have to fit in here, and everything has to be in proportion, and so on. Maybe most of us would like a little bit bigger brain, but that's how it goes. So you have to control growth to keep everything in proportion. And a tumor is a cell that's just growing and taking over. You don't want that either. You don't want any weeds. So you have to keep growth controlled. What if you overdo it? You could say, okay, won't let anything grow after you get older. That's safe. No cancer to worry about. Well, what's wrong with that? What'd you say?
Your cells die,
they don't, they're not replaced. Well, which of your cells die? In fact, the lining of your gut is replaced constantly. Your blood cells are replaced all the time. Every time you scrape something, you have a wound, you have to replace that. You have to have healing and replacement all the time or you wear out. It's not like you're built once and then you just work. You have to be constantly replenished. So you have to allow cell growth in order for you to function for, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100 years. So the question is, how are you going to balance all this? So the reason you have such a complicated control of growth is that if growth isn't almost exact, I know, the battery just ran out. It was low when we started, so I'm going to change it. If you don't have very careful control of growth, then what's going to happen is that you're not going to be able to function properly. Okay, so I'm just going to change the batteries. I'm not sure it's really necessary, but... Yeah, that did it, right? No, it did. Yeah, now it does. Took it a minute to catch. Okay. So you have a very complicated system for regulating growth. But what this means is it has many, many steps in them. And if any one of them screws up, either the cell dies and can't replace itself, or the cell grows out of control and you get a tumor. Now, if as long as the... doesn't happen too often, if occasional cell dies, it's no big deal. But if it grows too much, in some ways, that's worse. So let's look for a minute at what's wrong with cancer cells. As we've said earlier, almost all of them have something wrong with this G1 to S switch. Now, there are two possibilities here. To go from G1 to S, normally you require something from the outside, like a growth factor. And you need a whole bunch of things to be activated to kick in the next step. Well, a cell can become independent of those signals. A cell can go and proceed on its own without requiring positive signals. That will cause uncontrolled growth. Now, people have compared that to a stuck accelerator. So you don't need a positive. You have a sort of accelerator stuck. You are always on all the time, irregardless of what anybody tells you. The second possibility is that you ignore negative signals to stop. That also will allow you to grow when you shouldn't. If you don't require a positive or you don't pay attention to a negative, that's considered to be a kind of, you've broken the break. So that's a break problem. If either the accelerator gets stuck or the break doesn't work, the same thing sort of happens and the cell grows uncontrollably. Now, I just want to mention P53 because it's the most famous break there is. This protein is sometimes, and its gene, are sometimes called the guardian of the genome because they prevent the cell from proceeding if something is really seriously wrong. Now, I don't mean if there's one base changed. P53 doesn't know the difference. But if there is a major problem, like your DNA doesn't fold up properly, or there's a mutation that causes a big bend in the DNA, if there is a large change, that is detected either directly or indirectly, and that causes P53 to stop growth. Let's see where I put the big piece of Big Chuck. Oh, I put it over here. Now, the way this works is that P53 is an unstable protein. And under normal circumstances, you make P53, you degrade it, and that's the end of it. P53, by the way, the P stands for protein, and the 53 for its molecular weight, which is 53,000. When it was first discovered, nobody knew what it was good for. So P53 normally is made, degraded, nothing happens. But if you have damage, you have some kind of damage sensor, and if the DNA is badly damaged, then that stabilizes, through a series of events, P53. The P53 builds up, and it blocks progression into the cell cycle. So what good is that? It turns out that P53 has one of two effects, depending on how bad the damage is. That it can block temporarily. That's what it does first. Now, the reason that's helpful is that you have many enzymes for repairing and fixing DNA if there are mistakes in it. If your DNA gets broken, if certain kinds of mistakes occur, you have repair enzymes that can clean it up. So P53 basically is forcing the cell to wait and give the repair enzymes a chance to fix it. If they do, then the damage signal goes away, P53 is degraded, and the cell proceeds. But what if you can't fix it? The damage is so bad that the DNA cannot be fixed. What's the best thing to do with this cell? It's to get rid of it. Because then it can't do any more damage. Now, there are two ways that cells die. Did we ever talk about this before, necrosis? I don't think so. There are two ways that you can kill a cell, and they are called necrosis and apoptosis or apoptosis, depending on how you pronounce things. Necrosis means that the cell more or less explodes, spilling its guts and poisoning its neighbors. This is usually not good news. Apoptosis means that the cell basically commits suicide. It shrivels up, fractures its DNA, shrinks to nothing, and disappears. The various enzymes break up the proteins and the DNA, and they can be reused by other cells as raw materials. So it means that you get rid of the cell without any collateral damage. Now, we tend to think of growth as being the critical thing in life, but apoptosis is extremely important. If it weren't for apoptosis, you would have a hand like a duck. You would have skin in here. But the cells died off at the appropriate time through apoptosis, and you have separate fingers. So apoptosis is very important during development and sculpting the body, and even later, when something goes wrong, many cells die through apoptosis. Apoptosis is an active program. It requires certain enzymes and genes to be turned on in order to chew everything up without damage. So P53 generally causes apoptosis or self-destruction if the damage is bad enough. Many, many cancers have inactive P53. Well, so what? Somebody made a mouse, it's called knockout mouse, that has no P53 protein. Both copies of the gene are messed up, and the mice can't make any P53. What do you think happened to these mice? They were actually completely normal in the beginning. But they started dying of cancer at a fairly young age, and they all died of cancer. Because what does P53 do? It prevents altered cells from dividing and keeping at it. Cells that might be changed are killed before they can go on. If you don't have P53 mutations by themselves, don't do anything. But you've lost the editor. Before, anything that was bad enough got trashed. Now, change the DNA, big deal, gets published anyway. Everything continues. And the trouble is, without this screening device, sooner or later, one of the pieces of damage damages a gene responsible for some piece of this. The cell loses growth control, and it grows out of control. There are many cases like this of mutations that affect the ability to repair DNA. And they, people who have those mutations, have a much higher risk of cancer than the rest of us do. Because sooner or later, one of those unrepaired mistakes will mess up some part of this process, and the cells will grow out of control. Well, suppose a cell really has a broken switch here. In a few cases, that is sufficient to cause cancer, but it doesn't usually. Most cancer cells have many mutations, not one, many. What are those other mutations? So I briefly want to say what they are, and then we're going to come back and focus some more on these. Additional mutations just cause more loss of growth control. So they affect growth control. The more parts of this system are broken, the more likely the cell is to ignore other signals and grow by itself. But suppose a cell has no growth control at all, it just grows and it grows and it grows and it grows. What have you got? If that's all that happens, you have a benign tumor or a benign growth. I think you wouldn't even call it maybe a tumor. Now, that is not good news, but this is fixable. If you have a benign growth, they cut it off. They surgically remove it, and if you're lucky, it doesn't grow back. If you're unlucky, it grows back, and you get rid of it again. But as long as that lump of growing cells stays where it is, it doesn't do that much damage unless it specifically blocks something. Really dangerous tumor cells metastasize. They spread. So many of these other mutations increase the ability of the cell to metastasize, that is, to break loose from where it is and to spread through the blood and establish themselves somewhere else. That is the ability that we're really worried about, the ability to metastasize. And in order to do that, cells often have to change their extracellular matrix or their connections to their other cells or to the basal lamina. We talked about that a long time ago. If you turn on or off certain genes, that changes your connections and may free you up to move. I spelled this wrong. Now, so mutations can increase ability to grow independent of your neighbors. They can increase your ability to metastasize. Now, it's not enough to pick yourself up, move somewhere else, and sit down. If the cell is going to grow into a large tumor, into a large mass, it has to have a blood supply to deliver nutrients, oxygen, carry away waste, etc. And the process of producing a blood supply is called angiogenesis. That means just growth of blood vessels. So one of the things that tumor cells acquire is the ability to stimulate, through mutations, is the ability to stimulate the growth of blood vessels. If a tumor can't do that, then its size is limited. So one of the ways that people have tried to fight tumors is to block the growth of blood vessels. Now, at the moment, they haven't been quite that successful with it. When people first came up with this idea, I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, Jim Watson, who has a big mouth, claimed that that was the end of cancer. Forget it. We were going to block angiogenesis, and that would be the end of the problem. But unfortunately, it doesn't work quite that well. We hope eventually it will, that by blocking blood vessel growth, we will be able to stop cancer. But as of the moment, it's limited. And the primary thing that people use for this is called Avastin. Avastin is an antibody to the growth factor that cells need in order to... blood vessels need in order to grow. So this blocks the stimulus to the blood vessels to stop their growth. Now, one other thing that we have to think about here, I think actually there are two more, is you may remember this business about telomeres. That when you duplicate the DNA, because of problems with primer and replacement, the DNA of a linear chromosome gets a little bit shorter each time. Now, this limits the number of times one of your cells can divide, usually, to about 50 times. If you take some of your cells out and put them into a bottle, they will divide up to about 50 times. If they've already divided a bunch of times in you because you're older, you have to subtract that. So they subdivide about a total of 50, and then they tend to poop out. However, some cells make an enzyme which is called telomerase. And telomerase contains a small piece of RNA that acts as a template, and it allows cells to build back their DNA up to standard size. Your embryo cells, your early cells, contain telomerase. Another way of looking at it is, I think it's your germ cells that do. When you start with the egg and the sperm, all the telomeres are full length. Cancer cells often have telomerase. So what we're saying is that in the average adult somatic cell, telomerase genes are turned off and you don't make the enzyme and your telomeres just get shorter. But in cells that have telomerase there, because the gene was turned back on, they can build up the telomeres back up to normal length, and shortening of telomeres does not limit their lifetime. And they can divide an infinite number of times. So some cells have mutations that turn back on telomerase. Now the one I forgot besides that is, what else can a cancer do to promote its own growth at the expense of everybody else? And one of them is to evade apoptosis. Things like P53 normally trigger a series of events which result in apoptosis. If the cell no longer responds to those stimuli, then even if they get the kick that tells them you go commit suicide, go jump off the roof, they don't. They just grow anyway. And even though they have problems. So that's another, some mutations do that. They allow cells to evade apoptosis. You can see that all of these things allow cells to grow at the expense of other cells in a multicellular organism and ignore the standard signals that tell them either to start or to stop. Now, as we said, most cancer cells have multiple mutations, but almost all of them have mutations that affect the start G1 to S switch. And then they have those additional ones on top. But we're going to stick pretty much to the ones involved in the start kinase switch. And one of the reasons for that is that many cancers have mistakes in the same genes, make the same similar bad versions of the same proteins. And the hope is that we can target those proteins and those genes and stop the cancer from growing. P53 is an example of a gene that is mutated, and therefore the protein is missing in many, many cancers. Now, we don't have any hope of turning P53 back on, at least not at the moment. But there are a bunch of other genes which we think we can alter the expression of and help with cancer. Now, one example of this, maybe, is to look more closely at this part right here that we have been avoiding, which is how do growth factors get cells to make cyclin? How does that go wrong in cancer cells, and what can we do about it? Now, that whole sequence is actually on the bottom right of your handout. I said the bottom left, excuse me. So we're assuming that you have a receptor on the cell surface and the growth factor comes along. All the growth factors are proteins. So they use surface receptor type, surface receptors. So when the growth factor comes along and it binds to its receptor, the receptor's intracellular domain changes conformation. Now, we've talked about a whole bunch of receptors like this, but the receptors we talked about were all linked to G proteins. So this change in conformation activated a G protein, that activated an enzyme, and then you got a second messenger and so on. Now, most growth factors use a different kind of receptor. They use a receptor in which the cytoplasmic part or something that sticks to it is an enzyme. So they are catalytic. They have a catalytic domain which is activated by the binding of signal of growth factor. And the most common enzyme is a tyrosine kinase. They aren't all, but most of them are. That is, the enzyme that is activated is capable of adding phosphates to tyrosines, side chains, from ATP. So if you have a protein that has tyrosines, then this kinase allows you, with the help of ATP, you can phosphorylate these side chains. Now, most growth factors and a small number of endocrines work through this kind of receptor. Insulin works through this kind of receptor, and prolactin and growth hormone, which you may remember are two homologous hormones. Almost all the other hormones use G-protein-coupled receptors if they're water-soluble, and use transcription factor receptors if they're lipid-soluble. But the growth factors work this way. So what good is this? So you've activated an enzyme on the inside of the cell, and that phosphorylates, as it turns out, either itself or other proteins. What good is that? So now I'm going to draw the receptor again, except it's now phosphorylated. Now there are more details about how this works in your notes, and I'm not going to go into it. I want to talk about what is sort of critical about this and what is different from using a G-protein coupled receptor. So when you use a G-protein coupled receptor, what happens usually? So the receptor changes conformation, and you activate a G-protein, and you activate an enzyme like adenyl cyclase or phospholipase C, and you generate a second messenger. And that second messenger goes throughout the cell, broadcasts, and activates its targets wherever they are. Now, here you have a similar business of A kicks B, kicks C, kicks D, and E gets activated. But what is different is many of these receptors work by a phenomenon that's called recruitment. Instead of generating something that diffuses through the cell and activates its targets wherever they are, the receptor domain in the cytoplasm becomes sticky, and things stick to it. This is sort of like the tar baby. So it becomes sticky, and then the protein sticks to it, becomes sticky, and then another protein sticks to it, and so on, and you get a pileup. So a whole bunch of proteins end up stuck on top of this one. And each time a protein sticks, it gets activated. And then the next protein sticks to it, and it gets activated. Well, why is this different? Where is all this activation occurring? Notice it's happening where the receptor is in one part of the cell, not all over. So this is thought to be a very important feature because it allows certain proteins to be activated in a certain part of the cell, not having a broadcast effect. Now, sometimes the protein that binds is activated directly and does something. But sometimes a protein has to bind that does nothing but activate the next guy, which is nothing but activate the next guy. And finally, it's the guy at the end that does something. And one of the reasons for bringing this up is that there is a very famous series of proteins which are activated in this way and which are found to be altered in many, many cancers. And for that, you have to look at the bottom left here where it says TK-TEF cascade. Many growth factors work in this way. The growth factor becomes phosphorylated. And then that activates a set of proteins. And these are called adapter proteins because activating them just activates the next guy. They don't do anything. And then they activate a G protein, but this is a small G protein called RAS. This is what's called a small G protein. It's not trimeric, and it's not activated by a receptor. It's activated by an adapter protein. And this is a very, I should say, infamous protein because it is mutated in a very large percent of cancers of certain kinds. And the reason is that active RAS activates a kinase that activates a kinase that activates a kinase that activates a transcription factor, and the transcription factor causes you to make cyclin. And that's what that little cascade there is. RAS itself is not an enzyme, doesn't do anything. But RAS activates a kinase, which is sometimes called RAF. And then RAF activates something called MEK. And then active MEK activates something which is sometimes called ERK. And you notice that these have other names. That ERK is actually called MAP kinase. And MEK is called MAP kinase kinase. And RAF is called MAP kinase kinase kinase. But needless to say, those names are impossible. And so these things have other names. These usually have to do with how they were discovered. Like RAS was discovered, I think, in a virus, actually. And this is, I think, the first initial of the name. The name escapes me at the moment. Now, the final factor at the end, the kinase at the end, which is ERK or MAP kinase, activates a transcription factor. And that causes the synthesis of cyclin. When you have your usual G protein coupled receptor, and it activates a G protein, and it activates some enzymes, and you get a second messenger, usually you end up activating or inactivating some protein that's already there, that works in the cytoplasm. But you notice in this case, the protein that finally gets activated is a transcription factor, and it causes transcription, translation, and making new proteins. Now that happens sometimes with G protein coupled receptors, but it's rare. But it's very common with growth factors, that you trigger this series of kinases, and in the end, they activate a transcription factor, so you get transcription, and you get protein. Now, again, is this the way you want to run things? It seems very complicated. Well, the real answer is that's the way it is, that's the way it evolved. But the thought is that this involves an enormous amplification. Because one molecule of RAS probably activates one molecule of RAF, but then one molecule of active RAF, many of MEK, and one of MEK, many of ERK, and one of ERK, many of the transcription factor. But then the transcription factor causes the gene to be transcribed and make lots of messages. And each of those messages is read by ribosomes to make lots of protein. So in the end, you get a huge bang for your buck. Now, in a tumor, what would be wrong with RAS? What would happen if RAS were knocked out? Well, the transcription factor would come along and activate the receptor. The receptor would activate the adaptor proteins. And normally, the adaptor proteins activate RAS. But no RAS. End of line. We bound the growth factor, which hit the first domino and the next one and the next one, and then there's nothing. So we wouldn't trigger the production of cyclin, and we wouldn't get growth. So in fact, it's the opposite in cancer. In cancer, many cancer cells, RAS is active all the time. It is in overdrive. This is one of those stuck accelerator mutations. If RAS is, so to speak, on all the time, then you don't need any growth factor. All the time, RAS, you'll be making cyclin when you're not supposed to, and you'll be making going from G1 to S when nobody told you to do it. Now, RAS was originally discovered in a virus, but it's really a perfectly normal cellular protein. So how does it cause cancer? It's a perfectly normal protein. But what it's supposed to do is cycle from active to inactive, active to inactive, according to instructions. But if it gets stuck in the active form all the time, then you have a cancer problem. So people refer to the gene that codes for RAS. The normal version of the gene doesn't cause any problem. But the version of the gene that makes active RAS all the time is bad news. So the mutated gene that gives you always active RAS is called an oncogene because it's oncogenic, it causes cancer. And the normal version of the gene that's just doing what it's supposed to do and minding its own business is called a proto-oncogene. The virus carried a mutated version of it that was on all the time. Now let's go back to P53. We said if you knock out RAS, you don't get any growth. You don't get a tumor. But if you knock out P53, sooner or later you tend to get a tumor. So what do you call that? And this has a different name. A loss of P53 is like a broken brick. You have lost the brick. So people just call it an inactive. They don't have two names, really. They call the normal version of P53 gene is called a tumor suppressor. And when it doesn't work, they just say it's inactive or it doesn't work. Now, you understand, maybe the job of P53 is not to suppress tumors. The job of P53 is to keep things going properly. But the way you discovered P53 is that if you knock it out, you get tumors. And there are a lot of genes like this that are some kind of break. And if you inactivate them, then the cell grows when it shouldn't and you discover it. So the original gene is named a tumor suppressor. It could be called normality ensuring gene or something like that. But that's what people call it. Now, I guess while we're talking about tumor suppressors, we should just mention briefly this thing on the right here on the bottom, that RB is actually one of the other most famous tumor suppressors. I think we want to look at this picture again. We said here that when you finally get cyclin together with the catalytic subunit and you have an actual active start kinase, it adds phosphate to target proteins. This is on the top of 25B. Now, one of these target proteins is what is called RB. And what RB does is shown on the bottom right. RB is a break protein. And RB, in fact, sticks to another protein, which is a transcription factor called E2F. This is a transcription. RB is an inhibitor. So as long as these two are stuck together, the transcription factor does nothing. But if you phosphorylate RB, as shown on this handout, then the transcription factor is now released to do its thing. It can now go bind to DNA, trigger transcription. And what it actually triggers transcription are the genes that you need in order to replicate DNA, make histones, and go through S. So you basically can continue the cycle. Now, RB then is called a tumor suppressor. Because as long as you have good RB, you can keep E2F under control. But what happens if there is no RB in the cell at all? E2F is active all the time. And so there is no block when you get here to making the enzymes you need to get into S. You short circuit practically the whole thing. Now, it might be worth thinking about. If you have both, if P53 is working, but RB is knocked out, what happens? Are you okay? As long as P53 is working? P53 works upstream before RB. So if you screw something up down here, it doesn't matter what happened up there. But the reverse is not true. The point what we're saying is, if stuff further down the line is overactive, it doesn't matter if you block the signal here, the stuff down there is going to do its thing anyway. Now, let me just say a little bit about RB because of the way it was discovered. Can you inherit cancer? And the answer usually is no. You can inherit mutations that predispose you to cancer, but you don't inherit cancer itself. Now, most mutations that cause cancer are not inherited. They are what are called somatic mutations. And they're explained in the notes, but I don't know if we have time to go into all the details. That suppose there is a mutation in one of these cells. That's what we call a somatic mutation. There's a mistaken DNA replication in one of your ordinary cells. Now, does that affect your children? No, not at all. But does it affect you?
Yes.
Well, if the cell just dies, no, you're okay. But if that mutation causes that cell to grow uncontrollably, say to have overactive RAS or not to have active RB, then that cell can develop into a tumor. And that's the way most cancers are thought to happen. And when they're caused by viral infection, it's thought that the virus mimics a mutation. Either the virus lands in the middle of a gene and knocks it out, or the virus accidentally carries in an enhancer and turns on a gene that's supposed to be off. Because there are two ways you can turn a proto-oncogene into an oncogene. One way is to alter the protein coding sequence so that the protein is always in the active form. The other way is to change the regulator in front of the gene, say the enhancer, so that the gene is made all the time instead of when it's supposed to. Now, to come back to RB, we understand that to turn a proto-oncogene into an oncogene means you make the stuff all the time when you weren't supposed to, or you make one that's, say, stuck. You make a kinase that's stuck in this form all the time. You don't need growth factor. It's already active. But how do you turn a tumor suppressor, how do you knock it out? Usually you have a mutation or something lands in the middle of it, but you have two copies of everything. So if one copy, one of your RB genes gets messed up, what happens? The answer is nothing. But what if both RB genes in the same cell get knocked out? Then what happens is the E2F is now free to do its thing. It's free to trigger the production of the enzymes you need for S. And the cell is going to go into S every time. How does that happen? People, if you get no RB at all, you get a kind of eye cancer called retinoblastoma, and that's where its name comes from. It turns out that retinoblastoma is a very rare disease. It's very rare for a person with no relatives with it to turn up with it. But if you have relatives with it, especially a parent, you almost always get it. Now, how does this work? The problem is that you inherit one good copy and one messed up one. Now, a normal person inherits two good copies. So what is the chance, by rare accidental mutation, that both will get knocked out in a single cell? It's possible, but it's very rare. So very few people spontaneously develop a tumor because both of their RB genes were knocked out in one cell of the eye. And when it happens, usually it only happens in one of the two eyes. But people who inherit this They've already shot one copy. So all they need is one mutation. If they get one mutation in this copy, that cell will have no RB, and that cell will develop into a tumor. So you can inherit the one bad copy. Then usually what happens to people who do is that sometime during childhood, one of the other, in one cell, in each eye at least, the other copy gets knocked out by accident. And so a tumor develops, unfortunately, usually in both eyes. And this used to be incurable. It's now curable, but I think that to remove the tumor, the person ends up blind. But you can survive this tumor because now we understand what the problem is. All your other cells are okay. The cells of the tumor have knocked out this copy. But all your other body cells have one good copy, and they are generally okay. Okay. So the inheritedness of this is very interesting, but we won't go into it. Many tumor suppressors work in the same way, that if you inherit one bad copy and one good copy, there is a pretty good chance during your lifetime that at least in one of your cells, the other good copy will get inactivated and you will develop a tumor. And BRCA is that kind of gene. It's a tumor suppressor. It affects DNA repair. Okay. So let's just say a little bit about how you treat people who have cancer. That normally, the reason you have cancer, and we didn't go through all the part about how you get mutations, is that you have a mutation in one of the genes controlling one of these steps. So the traditional thing has been to blast you with either radiation, to maybe do surgery to remove most of the cells, and then to do radiation and to provide chemicals that interfere with cell division. And the idea is that these cells are cycling, and most of your cells are not. So by preferentially killing cycling cells, you are more likely to get the tumor than your regular cells. Unfortunately, some of your other cells go as well, which is why your hair usually falls out and your digestion goes to pot, because those cells that replenish your gut are not growing properly. But with luck, those cells grow back afterwards and the tumor does not. Now, people are trying to come up with something that's a little more subtle. That is, as we explained, using Avastin to prevent angiogenesis. And other ways of interfering with metastases. But a lot of what people are trying to do now is to restore growth control by inhibiting whatever protein it is that got out of control. And the most famous success involves a kinase. In at least one cancer, there is a kinase which is unusual in that it is always active. It's a result of a mutation which is a rearrangement, so that the actual kinase is a hybrid of two normal kinases. But the point is, the kinase is always in the active form. So people have discovered a small molecule that acts as an antagonist of this receptor. Remember, this kinase is also a receptor. And they've discovered a small molecule that binds to it and inhibits it. It blocks it. And it does not bind or to or block the normal kinase at all. And this compound is called Gleevec. And it is so far the most successful of the small molecule inhibitors that prevent the growth of cancer cells. Now, the only thing wrong is that what happens if you treat a person with Gleevec for a long time? Usually the cancer grows back. And the reason is that as the cancer cells divide, even if slowly, some of them get more mutations. And if you get a mutation so that you no longer bind Gleevec, that cell has an advantage over all the other cells, and it grows back. Cancer is a very Darwinian sort of situation where a cell gets a growth advantage over its neighbors and outgrows them. And then when additional mutations occur, some of those cells will be even better at some of these factors, and they will outgrow their neighbors and so on. So what people have tried to do now is instead of giving you a single drug, to give several at once. And the idea is that if you give somebody several drugs that target different targets, you have to have two or three separate mutations in different genes in order to become resistant. It's the same principle that's used in treating HIV and AIDS, that you give somebody multiple drugs at once, so the chance of a mutation arising that is resistant to all three at once is very low. So that's sort of where we are now. And in your notes, there is a reference to an issue of Science, which is, I think, March 25th, which is called The War on Cancer at 40. We've been at this for 40 years since the so-called War on Cancer was declared by Nixon. And we've spent a lot of money, and we've done a lot of research, and it explains both the timeline of what's been discovered and where we are now. The war was declared prematurely, according to all opinions, and so victory did not ensue. But over time, we've begun to find out more and more about what is responsible for cancer and to hone in on the defect and make more and more specific treatments. And the hope is that you now know enough that when you get to the stage where you are either treating it, writing about it, working on it, or developing drugs, you will be able to carry it on. So we'll stop here. Okay.